In February of 1924, in Aeolian Hall in New York City, musical history was made. In a concert billed as an experiment in modern music, the first ever performance was given of George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Nobody knew that work would become one of the most popular works of concert music written in America in the 20th century. That historic moment is now being recreated 90 years later on the same day and on the same New York City block where the original performance took place. Gershwin's Rhapsody and all of the less well-remembered works given in that program are being performed at Town Hall on February 12th by pianist Ted Rosenthal and an orchestra conducted by Maurice Paris. The heart of that orchestra is the great jazz band of New York City, the Nighthawks, led by Vince Giordano. Vince Giordano and Maurice Paris are with us today on WQXR. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jeff.
It's great. Now, the real headliner in that 1924 concert wasn't George Gershwin. It was Paul Whiteman, who was one of the most famous musicians in the country at that time. Who was he, and what did he do in that concert that was so experimental and modern? Vince?
Well, Paul Whiteman was a wonderful band leader. He wanted to take pop music and elevate it. He wanted to take jazz and elevate that also, because there was a lot of criticism on jazz. There were articles after articles from the Ladies' Home Journal, and made it, jazz must go. This was like what happened in rock and roll much later, and the older people just had a revolt. This is ruining the country. This is the worst. And Paul Whiteman, with his wonderful orchestrations by Ferdy Groffé and his dream and concept, turned that around.
Whiteman took out an insurance policy by having Zez Comfrey, who also had a huge name at that time. So he was counting on that to draw, and he had no idea what Gershwin would show up with. Of course, within a week before the concert, when they were rehearsing it, word got around town that they got something extraordinary in their program.
The Gershwin piece, Rhapsody in Blue, was commissioned by Paul Whiteman for the very purpose of this concert.
Yeah, an offhand commission. By the way, I'm doing a concert. Would you write us a piece with you playing the piano? He knew that Gershwin is a great pianist. He knew that already. But he didn't know he's a great classic or, you know, extended repertoire composer.
He'd already written lots of hit songs, lots of tunes that the world knew. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he wanted to be a classical musician, this is an ambition that had not been realized before the public at that
they
time.
They shared that ambition. And I think when the Ziegfeld Follies, when Gershwin wrote this little operatic scene, the Whiteman band was in the pit, and Whiteman realized that this guy has... He has chops, but more important, he wants to get out of the pit and get us out of the theater and into the concert hall.
So not only could he do it, but he wanted to do this as well. Maurice, you mentioned Zez Comfrey, who was also a huge star in the United States at that time, in a field of music that was a little bit experimental too. It was, well, we'd call it today sort of novelty piano, I guess, right?
Yeah, knucklebusters.
Dizzy Fingers and Kitten on the Keys are two pieces that lots of people know, but boy, he wrote tons of them and played them. And
they were on piano rolls. People had piano rolls at that time, and they would play their home. And some people, of course, try to work it out of themselves.
Right. So he was one of the big headliners on that show. Who's going to be playing the Knucklebusters?
Oh, he's a phenomenal musician named Jeb Patton, P-A-T-T-O-N. Jeb was a protege of Sir Roland Hanna at Queen's College, where I teach music, and... He also plays Chopin preludes and Beethoven sonatas. I mean, this guy's an amazing, amazing musician.
There were lots of other composers represented on this concert, some names from the classical world and the popular world. So Rudolf Frimmel shows up. Victor Herbert showed up in this concert. Irving Berlin and Jerome Kern. This is a crazy, it sounds today like a crazy mixture. Was it then, or was Whiteman deliberately putting these things together?
Oh, I think he deliberately was doing that. This was an experiment in modern music, as he termed it, and by Victor Herbert, who everyone respected and loved. It turned out it was Victor Herbert's last piece, because he died shortly after this concert, and it's an amazing potpourri of different themes, like... Asian themes and a Cuban theme and...
All these exotic sounds in American music at that time.
There was a guru behind Whiteman. His name was Gilbert Seldes. Gilbert Seldes wrote a book called The Seven Lively Arts, in which he argued that American pop art is the equivalent of European high art. Crazy Cat is Picasso. James Reese Europe is Mook, the conductor of the Boston Symphony. Charlie Chaplin is Shakespeare. And so, and he mentions Gershwin. And so the whole sense that Whiteman went on stage with this support from this critic, he was a famous critic and author, you got the real stuff out there, go out and, you know, show. I think that Gilbert Seldes helped him to choose and line up the program, and he gave talks from the stage, I understand. And he laid out the concert in such ways like 100 years ago, jazz 100 years ago and today, and then comedy pieces and so forth, so that there was like an instruction to the audience. Of course, they didn't hear it that way, but I think that was the notion that they went in on. We're going to do this great experiment and show everybody how powerful, how important, how real is this art form.
That really speaks highly of Whiteman, not just as a pop artist, but as a thinking musician.
Yeah.
And yet, Whiteman was a huge radio star and made tons and tons of phonograph records.
Yes, his Victor records just sold in the millions, and there were bands all over the country and all over the world buying those records and trying to emulate the sound of that orchestra.
What was it, Vince? What was the sound of Paul Whiteman's orchestra?
The sound of the orchestra was the wonderful arrangements by Ferdy Groffay and the other people that played in his band, like Ross Gorman. The saxophone section, which was created for that orchestra, the idea of the brass versus the saxes, you know, they'd have a...
And the doubling.
The doubling, all the amazing instruments that if you see the original program, Ross Gorman played so many instruments.
11, played 11 instruments.
We have to have two people in Ross Gorman's chair. That's how many instruments have to be covered. So there was this variety. Whiteman was a classical player. He played viola in the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra. So he had a love of great music, and he had a love of this newfangled music, jazz. And, you know, how can we put that together and make something great out of it?
The site of this concert was Aeolian Hall. Aeolian was a piano company.
That's correct.
And they built a concert hall.
Aeolian Hall was a block thick. So the entrance to the piano
showroom
is on 42nd Street. The ticket and box office entrance is on 43rd Street. And yes, that hall was free that particular day. It was Lincoln's birthday. And he gave it as an afternoon concert. He was wearing, he wore the afternoon suit that conductors used to wear at the time with striped pants and an ascot. He really played it out as, this is a concert, and my guys are going to be dressed in concert dress.
Vince, what have you and Maurice done to get this concert together? Because not every note that was played in that original concert was written down for the musicians. Am I right on that?
No, it was written down. I think that,
like I said, every note in that concert was
I think what's
down.
Interesting is Whiteman's notion that when we play something that we've recorded, and the audience will hear exactly what we had played before, there are hot solos in the concert. You do the tune straight, and then the trombone plays a solo, so forth. But the notion of solos being improvised on the spot had not really opened up yet. That was done by Louis Armstrong when he came to play with Fletcher Henderson here in New York City in 1924, and Whiteman and Ferdy went to hear the band. With that gig, Louis Armstrong demonstrated that you don't have to play the same solo every night. And this idea of being creative, not just repeating yourself, fighting with yourself not to repeat yourself, that notion was only born that same year. So it's an interesting contrast. And in time, Whiteman got Bick Spiderbeck to cover that idea.
Yes.
And help lead his musicians along in that field.
And play different solos every night, hopefully.
One of the other key people in the Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue story is this guy, Ferdy Groffay, whom most audiences know as the writer of the Grand Canyon Suite. He was a terrific American musician and a singular force in the Whiteman band, but who else was this guy, Ferdy Groffay?
Well, he had this idea of how to take an American dance band and create these sections of like the brass section, which was two trumpets and a trombone at the time, and three saxophones and all the doubling, mixed in with the rhythm section of a piano, banjo, tuba or bass, and drums, and create this symphonic jazz idea. And he not only was the chief arranger, but the pianist of the Whiteman Band.
Rhapsody in Blue is the most well-known piece on this program to audiences today, but it's not known in the form that is going to be presented that night. Gershwin didn't write out the band's part, if I understand correctly.
In my book, Dvorak to Duke Ellington, I really examined that whole dispute that went on. Gershwin, after the Rhapsody in Blue, was accused of being only a part-time composer because he had not orchestrated the Rhapsody in Blue. Ferdy orchestrated it. One of the reasons that Ferdy orchestrated it is he knew what the different guys played in the form of doubling. It was very complicated to write for three saxes who were playing over 20 instruments. And he also knew how to make the band work. Gershwin had written the run for the clarinet. It's in the pencil score.
That opening glissando.
And later on, he mentions names of instruments in that pencil score because he had the sound of the Whiteman Band in his ear. He knew what he was writing for. But it took Ferdy to make it realize.
And the other reason was there was a lack of time where Gershwin had forgotten that he was commissioned to write this. He was on a train reading the newspaper and fell out of his chair when he said, "Oh, my God, that's that piece that Paul Wyman asked me to write." And Gershwin would scurry these parts out and throw them at Groffé. Groffé would orchestrate it, and they'd rehearse it at the Palais Royal where they were playing on 48th Street. And this was put together so incredibly quick.
From that time on, Gershwin did all his own orchestrations and was very stubborn about it. For example, the next piece he wrote was the Concerto in F for Damrosch, who said to him after the concert, "Now write a real piano concerto." I mean, such insulting things. But anyway, so what Gershwin did was he actually did the orchestration. And before he gave the score to Damrosch, he went into one of the theaters where one of his shows was being performed and had the band come on stage, and he played the piano, and someone else conducted so he could hear his orchestration. Mm-hmm. Then he gave it to Damrosch. So he was training himself, you know, see how good my stuff is. He did the same thing for Porgy and Bess. Mm-hmm. He had this test of his orchestrations.
And in the concert, Gershwin did not write down his parts. Now,
there's one place where he says, "Wait for nod."
Wow.
It's on the score. Yeah. It's just before Dante. He does this big cadenza, and then he does it. And then he gives a nod to Whiteman. Now you can play.
Did Gershwin write down the part later on? Did he write it down, or was it transcribed? The part that the pianist plays.
I have the copy that was given to Milton Rettenberg, who is the person who replaced George on the tour. George went back to New York to work on a show.
And the Whiteman Band took the show on the road.
Well, they were still on the road. They were on the road. They went from St. Louis. Or they went right across. They followed the train right across the country and came back. And that was in the spring of 24. And they came back and made a recording with George. But George left in the middle of the tour, and Milton Rettenberg, who was one of the rhythm piano guys with Ferdy, was given a copy of what Ferdy orchestrated from. I have that copy. Gershwin did sign it.
So all the notes that Gershwin didn't write down in the original performance, he did write down later.
In fact, we're doing three or four bars of music that most people never heard that were played in 24. Yeah, we are playing a few phrases that weren't played in 24.
That's just great.
Yeah, so I think the cuts were good. I think they improved the piece, but I'm playing them anyway. Just so, I don't know, you know. Just
in the spirit of recreation?
Yeah, exactly.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. So after that initial performance, then the Rhapsody got turned into a piece just for symphony orchestra, leaving out those disgusting saxophones that sully our concert
hall. No, the saxophones are there.
And the banjo, right.
The banjo and saxophones are there, but they're totally buried. I call it the Hollywood Bowl version. That's the version that we grew up on.
Well,
know.
But was that Freddie Groffé's work, or is that the same arrangement?
No,
they just buried the parts?
Another arranger got in on it. He used some of the colors of Freddie Groffé, but once you bury the saxes, you know, you change the nature of the piece. The original version is meaner and leaner. And the band is flying. I want to say one thing I think is very important to say. Why was the Rhapsody so immensely successful? It takes this whole concert to understand that. Here's this wonderful orchestra of superb musicians, extraordinary musicians, ragtiming all night, you know, and you hear these colors that Vince talked about, the banjo and tuba, the three saxophones, the muted trumpets, all these sounds, and these licks, these ragtime licks all night long, and these harmonies, and all of that material is suddenly swept together into a work of art by Gershwin. And the Rhapsody could not have existed if this other music didn't exist, which is the truth for Mozart and Beethoven. And Bach, they fed from the music of the people. And that's exactly what Gershwin did. And that's the genius behind this piece.
Maurice Paris talking about Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. The 90th anniversary recreation of the concert that introduced it takes place at the Town Hall on Wednesday, February 12th, with the band led by Vince Giordano, his band, the Nighthawks. One of the most famous moments, of course, in the Rhapsody in Blue is that very first note, that famous thing the clarinet does that adds such an incredible flavor to it. I'd like you to talk about that a little bit.
Ross Gorman looked at the piece. He was the clarinet player, and he played it the way Gershwin wrote it. And then all of a sudden, because he was a very quirky guy, he played all these instruments and had a lot of command of his instrument. It was amazing. And he decides to just make this slide.
So in the original score, those were all discrete notes that
went up? It was a regular scale going up from low, low F to the high B flat. But the story I heard from a man who was at the rehearsal was that Gorman said to Gershwin, I can slide this. I can glissando this if you want me to. And Gershwin says, go right ahead. And Gorman, who obviously had played a lot of Jewish weddings, he adds some klezmorum to this whole thing. I mean, he gets all the little turns and bends and twists. And this outrageous opening suddenly is born. You know, that's the greatest idea of music, that the players and the composers feed on each other.
Some of the sound of this music, though, Vince, depends on particular instruments. And some of these sounds you can't make on instruments that come out of factories today. You got to have the original stuff. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, we have a lot of vintage instruments in the band. And almost more importantly is the vintage thinking that
right.
we have in the yeah. band. It's like a lost language. You have many wonderful, unbelievable musicians running around today, but they must speak in this older language, meaning that they have to have their hearts and their minds and their lips all as interpreters, almost like one interprets Shakespeare.
And remember, it's music for dancing. So the dancers expected a particular rhythmic accuracy. So what Vince is referring to is this, the guys have to relearn that rhythmic approach of ragtimers. Otherwise, they can't play this.
Yeah, very on top of the beat. There's also vibrato, mm-hmm. which is so necessary, and most jazz players don't play this way anymore.
You're working from scores that are original Whiteman scores or transcriptions that have been made. You've made some transcriptions. Where did the source materials for your work come from, Maurice?
A lot from Williams College, because Whiteman, by some fluke, gave his library to them. Some of the parts we're playing from are photographs of the parts that the band played from in 1924. The hard piece to find was the Victor Herbert. There was a single score of this found at the New York Public Library. Mm-hmm. And once I had that in my hands, I had the show.
The Rhapsody in Blue was the last piece on the program? Is that right?
Not really. He played the dum, da-da-dum, dum, dum. Pomp and Circumstance after the Rhapsody. But, you know, the concert was repeated several times here in New York and in Philadelphia and then went on tour. And, of course, he never again touched Pomp and Circumstance. By that time, it was clear the Rhapsody was the payoff of the whole concert.
So why do this concert? You guys are fronting it.
We love it. We love this music. And when we realized that it was the 90th year, we couldn't let it go by. We checked Town Hall. Town Hall was dark.
Yeah.
And we went in there, and they said, gee, this is not enough time. You might lose money. We
yeah.
don't care.
Yeah,
we love
right.
this,
yeah.
and it's too important.
Tell me about the fellow who's playing the role of George Gershwin at this concert.
Boy. Ted Rosenthal, he's got the classical chops, and of course he understands jazz. He's an amazing prize winner, one of the first prize winners of the Thelonious Monk competition. Ted comes out of the swing and bebop era. Ted let it be known to me that he knew the Rhapsody, and we've done it now 3-4 times together. And
he's amazing.
He's a wonderful player. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have criticized the Rhapsody in Blue, including my mentor, Leonard Bernstein, as he said, it's a string of pearls or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, it's form. Well, it doesn't have a form that you can take
apart.
It does
have a form. They say this word form gives me a... All of the critics at that time were Germanophiles. As far as they were concerned, form meant Beethoven. But in between Beethoven and Gershwin was a guy named Claude Debussy, who argued against a French composer writing in a Germanic style, according to some formula that had been set up 80 years before him. So he broke the mold. Debussy, in fact, he called it an evolving form. He gets an idea, and it takes him to a new place, and it takes him to a new place, and it doesn't follow the old. So the notion that Gershwin didn't use a form is dishonest and not true, because he did. He starts in the classical blues key of B flat major. The big slow tune is in E major. That's as far away as you can get from B-flat major. And the end of the piece is back to B-flat major. So there was this arch. There was this arch. And if you listen to the clarinet and trumpet at the beginning, those tunes become the heart and soul of the whole piece. So for people to downgrade Gershwin in any way, to me, is offensive. Because if you really study the music, and if you really know human music history, all of these so-called critiques and even the critique of the orchestration, fall by the wayside.
Normally when we hear the Rhapsody, you've got the violins, you've got 40 violins in their lush section. For this, you've got to import people to play this because they don't live in this world very much. How many strings are in this band?
8 violins and 1 double bass. And the violins are divided into 4 parts. So you're hearing 4-part harmony come out of 8 fiddles.
And that was from Groffé's original orchestration the Whiteman Band, but that was a supplement to the Whiteman Band at that time.
Yeah, it had been done by Will Marion Cook in 1918. He had a band that had fiddles in it. But this was the first presentation in New York of this kind of mix between classic and jazz.
An experiment in modern music. So we have a chance to go back and experience American music and experimental music 90 years ago, in the 90th anniversary recreation of Paul Whiteman's concert at Aeolian Hall, just down the block at Town Hall on Wednesday, February 12th. Vince Giordano, leader of the Nighthawks, you'll see him on stage there, and Maurice Paris, who reconstructed this concert and will conduct it. Gentlemen, thank you so much for visiting WQXR.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff, for all you do.